This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, bring on the heartbreak, when the romantic subplot goes wrong in speculative fiction.
So before we start, I just want to put it out there to the universe that that was just the title. That was not actually an invitation.
Yeah, sometimes I phrase these titles a bit ambiguously.
You do, and it's like some demon is just sitting in hell, just like rubbing its hands together like, oh, ho, ho, ho.
At last my time has come.
So without out of the way, that little disclaimer. Why have we decided to do this episode today?
Well, it's coming up for Valentine's Day.
It certainly is. Which is why we thought that on this day, which is celebrated for love and romance, we would talk about heartbreak instead.
Have you never broken up with someone on Valentine's Day?
Jules. Jules.
Okay, that's a no then.
Oh, Jules, no!
I think I once broke up with someone on their birthday, but, you know, that's a little aside. We'll just...
Jules!
Well, when it's over, it's over.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Oh, dear me.
I was a heartless teenager, okay?
A kid is a kid is a kid, I guess.
But, yeah, aside from the very, you know, pithy answer of it's Valentine's Day, this is an aspect of the whole sort of romance insert. Can I say insert with romance without it sounding filthy? I don't know if I can. Now I can't because I've made it weird. Okay, but I'm just going to roll into it anyway. I'm balls deep, therefore I'm going to finish.
Oh, come on!
I'm really sorry.
But you're not.
Well, I'm not sorry, but I am kind of sorry adjacent. Okay, more to the point, more to the point. Stay on target. This is part of the romance within a fantasy, science fiction, other types of speculative fiction. Obviously, it quite often forms the subplot. And we've never really talked about what happens when you have a functioning relationship and it goes wrong, or when two characters just can't really get it together. So we've talked about toxic romances. We've talked about romantic tropes, particularly within YA speculative fiction, but we haven't tackled this side of it, and I think there is a knack to writing it in a way that a reader will actually engage with.
Yeah.
And also there, as a reader, there are tropes that you love and you hate, and tropes that work when someone does it and do not work when somebody else does it, and I think it's worth sort of exploring that a little bit.
I quite agree. So I guess then before we really start, we should define what we mean by you know, because as you say, it's not about toxic relationships. It's about the kind of relationships breaking up in a natural or sometimes unnatural way, but not because of necessarily. Because one of them is an abuser or something like that.
It's specifically looking at breakups and just not being able to get off the ground in the first place.
Yeah,
in speculative fiction, there's another dimension to that, because some relationships crumble under external pressures, as we know, and we have touched on before. In the sense of speculative fiction, fantasy and science fiction, etc., sometimes those relationships that start to go wrong because of external pressures, those external pressures can be, you know, things that you don't necessarily have a frame of reference for in the real world. So things like magic and things like your fated soulmates, but that means you haven't actually got a choice. Or perhaps it's the ultimate long distance relationship where you're living on different planets. So so it's things that you can sort of see a way into, but it's looking at how speculative fiction sort of deals with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I guess what we need to address then, what we really need to look at is actually why, first of all, we would want to write or read about heartbreak in a relationship.
Yeah. Well, you want to write it because, A, hopefully it furthers your plot and is actually part of your narrative. And B, because maybe you want to make your readers cry.
Yep, that's valid.
No, you want to make them feel like that. You want to make them not feel bad because you're a sadist or anything, but, well, not entirely because of that. Yeah, I mean, whatever your character goes through, you should be wanting your reader to feel like they're being put through the same thing. And I imagine as a reader, you want to read that because you get some sort of catharsis from it.
Yeah.
Or it helps you make sense of the real world, particularly in terms of speculative fiction.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I also think that there's an element of the fact that there's potentially something quite healthy about portraying heartbreak.
Yeah.
Because the idea of the one true love, the perfect, or anything like that, for me, I find it a little bit distressing. And the whole idea about heartbreak is that heartbreak can't be achieved unless there was love there. And the idea that heartbreak happens and then life continues, I think, is relatively important. Now, obviously, it's not always portrayed in that way. Sometimes that heartbreak leads to literal death. But in other cases, it's actually quite cathartic to see someone survive heartbreak and for there to be a sense of hope at the end of that.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I'm for anything which will challenge the one true love trope. Yeah. That's not to say that some people don't meet the person who is right for them and they work at the relationship and they make it work and they stay together their entire lives. They meet as teenagers and, you know, they grow all together. And that's lovely. But it's an unrealistic standard to expect everybody else to meet because there's however many billion people in the world and you're assuming that the person who was your childhood friend is the perfect person for you. I feel that that's an unfair expectation and it's one that gets weighted particularly on girls in the sense of if you can't make this work, you don't find the one, then you're getting a little bit more tired and a little bit less desirable every time you go around the track. Yeah. And that's something I really want exploded as well. So, I mean, this all feeds into that and I think that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so there's actually quite a lot for us to talk about here.
There's a lot of tropes. I think it falls into two broad categories, as we've said. Yeah. So there's the relationships that start out and for whatever reason they break up, they break down, they split up. And then there are the characters who, on some level, they're right for each other because the reader must feel that they're a possibility. And I don't just mean in the sense of, no, I totally ship this character more with this one. I mean in the sense of that it's canonically there in the narrative that there is some sort of attraction between these two characters, so it could absolutely happen.
Yeah.
And yet they never manage to be in the right place at the right time together in order to kind of make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think if we break it in half and we'll do lots of breaking this episode. We'll break it in half and we will go with tropes, both good and bad, for breakups to start with, and then we will look at tropes, both good and bad, for characters who can't get it together.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That sounds like a good idea. That sounds manageable.
Yeah. Because otherwise, I realised that the list I've written that we've compiled together is actually a bit, epic.
Well, it seems appropriate, really. So I guess we should really start with hints, signals, and foreshadowing. It shouldn't come out of nowhere for the reader.
Yeah, and it's for the reader part that's really important. Yeah. In the sense of, you know, you can have a couple that are together and they're happy, and then the next minute it's all over. And usually at least one of them has seen it coming.
Yeah.
And there should be clues in the narrative, you know, like missed dates or, you know, mysterious phone calls, or one seems a bit colder and a bit more off than the other. it should not come, you know, unless the other one's completely clueless, it shouldn't completely come out of the blue for them either.
Yeah. And I guess the thing is that it depends on the narrative that you're trying to tell. For instance, if you're kind of starting out a story where it just sort of, you're kind of really meant to be blindsiding people. And this is a technique that can be used, but in which case it's being used on purpose in order to blindside. Because if you at the right at the beginning of a story, you just seem to have this perfect relationship and then it completely breaks up. And then it just suddenly they break up. And then basically over the course of the story, you kind of unpick why and what happens. You can do it like that.
Yeah.
But I...
Sort of a Gone Girl thing, but perhaps without the presumed murder.
But on the other side, I do tend to think that in terms of actually having satisfactory... well, I mean, you always need foreshadowing, really. There needs to be material there that the reader can observe in some form or another. That becomes a lot trickier if you're writing from the first person perspective. But I do think it kind of does need to be there in some way, even if it's just kind of in the background, very, very subtly.
Yeah. And it absolutely can be done as well, and even in first person. I mean, if you're in third person, you can clearly show one person having doubts, or you can show it through how they speak to the other person, and perhaps the other person just so desperately doesn't want it to be true, they're just not picking up on the cues, but the reader is. And in first person, again, you've just changed the perspective slightly, so there are clues and things, but that particular person, your POV character, writes it off as they're having a bad day, or, you know, they're having a stressful time at work, or, you know, someone's threatening to blow up the planet in speculative fiction terms, so perhaps they're not really thinking about romance right now.
Which, to be honest, fair enough.
Yeah, actually, there is a chain of priority there, definitely.
But, sorry. I was just thinking, I know that when someone is trying to blow up my planet, I don't feel that romantic usually.
Yeah. Oh, we could riff off that for ages, so I think we should move from that.
I think we should, yes.
I foresee a rabbit hole opening. Yeah, it as you say, you can shock the reader with it and then use the story to be going back and unpicking why and what's happened. I think that's less of a thing that happens in speculative fiction, usually because romance isn't the point, unless you're writing romantic fantasy or paranormal romance or what have you.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can absolutely do it that way. But again, it hasn't come out of nowhere. You find out ultimately it hasn't come out of nowhere. Not sort of, oh, we were so happy together, the next day you're dumped. And no one ever gets any kind of resolution. And that's incredibly unsatisfying.
Definitely.
In my opinion.
Yeah, so you don't want that at all. That would not make happy readers be.
There really doesn't have to be a bad guy. Usually in relationships, which are very complicated, it's not a case of one person done somebody else wrong. There's usually a case of there's mutual culpability there. It might be more weighted on one side than the other. Or it might be a case of they've just realised they're not right together, that actually they form a damaging dynamic when they're together, or one of them has. And one or other, or perhaps even both of them together, have decided to end it. There doesn't have to be a bad guy. And from this one, I would go on and say that once you've broken up your couple, you then don't have to spend another two or three books tearing down the previous lover, because we need to feed into this idea that there is one true love, and that obviously wasn't the one, and therefore we're going to minimise the love that the main character had for this previous lover, and you know, make it out to be that it wasn't actually real and that she was taken in from the start, etc., and that he was just a bad guy.
Ooh, I feel like maybe we're talking about a certain book here, but
well, certain series, definitely. It is a good example of not what not to do, though, in fairness. You don't have... Sarah J. Maas did not have to completely demonise Tamlin in the A Court of Thorns and Roses series. He didn't, she could have written a story. She obviously wanted to write an abuse survivor narrative, and that's fine. But there was no nuance, even though he was also a survivor. And, you know, together they were toxic. I mean, in some ways, the fact that she wasn't making her feelings and things known bordered on emotional abuse in her case. And certainly everything she does afterwards is kind of abusive towards him. So there's definitely a little bit on both sides there, but that's never explored. It's all about grinding this previous lover down into the dirt. And it's kind of sickening.
I should point out that that's not us saying that what Tamlin does is any way excusable in the book. That is an abusive relationship. But the point is that there was a decision there to make that relationship abusive rather than just making it toxic, and that to then over the course of the next few books turn Tamlin into something that he really didn't appear to be in the first one. Now of course that's fine, because you do have people who are like that, and there were warning signs in the first book if you look back and read them, but at the same time that was a decision that was made, and I do feel like there was extra effort put on the part of Sarah J. Maas to really, really demonise Tamlin in order to make Rhysand a better saint, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, if you can only make the next prospective romantic interest good by completely tearing apart the previous one, then you don't have a very good character. It's as simple as that, because if they can't stand on their own two feet without a basis for comparison like that, they're just not a very good character. At some point, that character will collapse, as we saw. not throwing beanie babies here, but seriously, that is literally what happened. Hopefully he'll come back at some point. You never know. But I think there were very questionable things about Rhysand as well, as we've talked about. So that neither of them were really great choice. What was interesting was that she could have chosen a narrative whereby Tamlin wasn't actually abusive. He just wasn't supportive of the fact that Feyre was going through something, and he was pushing her along towards a wedding that she wasn't ready for, and he was ignoring her needs and things. That's not the same as being actively abusive. That's just being kind of a selfish asshole. And he could have just done that rather than, you know, turning him into crazy throwing things person.
Yes.
And you certainly could have then had Feyre having a very difficult choice of, well, I love him, but I can see that this is not healthy. And my survival depends on being away from somebody like that right now. Someone who can't put my needs first.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Again, I feel obviously a little bit differently about the series than you do.
Yeah. The fact she chose to portray abuse like that, she actually did that very well. And she also did it well with the fact that Feyre doesn't join Rhysand and then jump into bed with him. I will skip over the fact that Rhysand manipulated her into that position in the first place and kind of manipulated it, even if it was for her own good all the way through. You know, it gave Feyre time to heal and process, etc. And that's a really important thing to be portraying. It does, however, also tap into one of these tropes that I find slightly harmful that I don't think was explored properly, and that is the mating bond.
Right, yes.
I've seen other things do this. You've got things like Cressley Cole's Immortals After Dark series, which is a guilty pleasure, but let's face it, it's smut with vampires, werewolves and shapeshifters and things. And again, you know, the males form a, and they are called males because they're very manly and male, form mating bonds, and then they have to win the females over. So you can see that it is pure wish fulfillment in that respect. And weirdly, I find it less harmful in those books because they are not pretending to be anything than what they are, which is smut with a cast of vampires. Yeah. And that's okay, because you see exactly what you're getting and you can choose not to read it if you don't want to. That's fine. Whereas I find the idea of like soulmates and the mating bond and things troubling, particularly in young adult fiction and new adult.
Yeah. I can understand the allure of it, the idea that there is someone out there who is perfect for you. And of course, it is a little bit more nuanced in A Court of Thorns and Roses, because they do actually acknowledge the fact that the mating bond doesn't necessarily produce good relationships. And that it might be something which is more kind of to do with power and levels and having children and things like that. Because obviously they do portray that, you know, you have these mates who are actually ultimately very bad for each other and who don't have happy relationships. So I did like that. I did like that it's not necessarily something which means it's the perfect relationship. It might be something a little bit more biological, a little bit more visceral. So I did like that change. And I can understand the whole romance of the mate idea. But I do see your point, certainly in terms of continuing that trope of the one true love, to be honest, another reason that the one true love thing troubles me is that it's also, it glorifies this idea that if for some reason that doesn't turn out, there's just death afterwards, you know?
Yeah, or some kind of emotional death, yeah.
But it's like, if I cannot be with the person that I truly love, either because they've left me or because they've died or something like that, then I will now be alone and single for the rest of my life, or I will literally die from the pain of it. Now, there are some people who, of course, who do make that decision and say, I can't actually be with anyone else after this. Looking from a personal point of view, my grandmother, after my grandfather died, she was like, nope, can't possibly. I just couldn't think of life with anybody else, you know? And so I can understand that. I can respect that. Fair enough. Whereas, of course, some other people I know have lost partners, have mourned them and loved them, and haven't, that love has not diminished at all by them then choosing to actively engage in another relationship and fall in love again. And I think there's this incredible demonization that surrounds that the idea of the second chance. And I think we're a little bit more willing to forgive it if it's because someone's died. But I also think it's really, really sad to present this idea to young, impressionable people and say, if the relationship you are in now, basically, which is, you know, going to be the big, intense one, if that relationship doesn't work out and you claimed you love them, then ain't nobody else going to be for you. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, both of my grandmothers did the same sort of thing. It's a little bit different, I think, after someone's been married for 30, 40 years as well. Because sometimes the idea of setting up house with somebody else is also a massive, massive hurdle. But yeah, if it's after a breakup and it's a case of, no, there's no one else for me, okay, on some level I'll accept that. But if you're saying that was your entire life, and you're now not going to go on and live any kind of life of any meaning, then that is really disturbing. Yeah.
And I think the particularly disturbing aspect about it is that it actually puts people who are in a vulnerable position in a relationship under pressure to stay in that relationship. Because they think, there's no way that I can do better. There's no way that, you know, this is my one and only chance.
Yeah, which is... Yeah. All kinds of bad, obviously. So. Okay, so back on the breakup mechanisms, the internal struggle, it's not you, it's me, which obviously is kind of, it's on the dumping bingo card. So if you've got that one, you can tick it off. it's not you, it's me. Sometimes it genuinely isn't the other person. Sometimes people split up with someone because they have not got the mental energy, they don't feel right and equal and balanced within themselves enough to continue a relationship. And they believe it would be unfair to the other person. And they believe it would be unfair to themselves, importantly enough. That is a thing that that people who are experiencing very, very low depression periods and things, extended ones, sometimes say, you know, that's it, I kind of need to be by myself. I cannot put in the effort required to maintain this sort of relationship. And that's horrible for the other person, and it's horrible for the person doing it, but sometimes that is actually the thing that is doing the least amount of harm. I have certainly split up with people, not because I was depressed, but because I emotionally knew I was not in a position where I could give them the sort of attention they deserved. I mean, on dumping card bingo, I've probably done most of them. I expect I've got a full house. So, this is why you don't come to me for romantic advice. But yeah, I mean, if you're looking at it in terms of speculative fiction, however, the internal struggle can take on some interesting characteristics. For example, you split up with somebody because you can't tell them what the horrible, terrible danger is. You physically cannot tell them because you're cursed. And you know it's going to put them in the path of something you can't even warn them about. And this might be a misguided attempt to protect them, but it's not actually done out of any kind of malice, and you don't necessarily actually want to split up with them.
Or it could also be the... it just makes me think about Twilight, where Edward tries to walk away, and that's seen as a negative thing, and I'm like, no!
He's choosing to not let his family, who kind of want to eat her and can't help the fact they want to eat her, not eat her.
Yeah.
You know? It's bad in the sense of it takes someone else's choice away because they're not deciding things equally. However, at that point, the relationship isn't equal. If one person wants out, then the relationship is already not equal. So somebody has to make the decision.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other problem with that is that Bella is portrayed as the weirdest teenager I've ever seen in my life. In that, yeah, so she has this bond with Edward, and I understand it, and she's deeply in love with him. And then she has the depression, and I completely understand that, but she behaves in a totally neurotic way, and they really shouldn't have gotten back together again, all things considered. They shouldn't have really broken up the way that they did. I think there was a big, massive breakdown in conversation, and the fact that Edward didn't really want to break up with her. He was just scared.
He did it in a way that was cruel because he believed she wouldn't let go.
Yeah. And he was right. She wouldn't let go.
I mean, I can understand. Yeah, obviously he didn't exactly leave her safe and protected like he thought, did he?
No.
I can understand it. Obviously, M breaks up with... Ah, oh my God, is this a spoiler for book 4? Bugger. Yes, one of my characters breaks up with another character, again, out of a desire to protect them. And it is bad, and he's absolutely right to call her on it later and say, look, you took my choice away. Even though he understands that she could not physically say anything at the time. But it was still bad. There was no good decision to be made in that instance.
No. And I also do think that's worth exploring as well, which is that understanding why something happened doesn't change the fact that it might have hurt someone.
Yeah.
But also that sometimes actually painful decisions do need to be made. And that doesn't necessarily make the person who's made them a villain. It just makes it part of a complicated, you know, complicated dynamic, which is always going to be the case whenever you have two people involved in something who can't, you know, read each other's minds.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, the actual physical act of breaking up for somebody. So many authors who I've read and who I've seen working on things like this seem to think it has to result in a screaming match. Or, you know, that somehow people throwing coffee pots and glasses and pans and things to denote their extreme emotional state is kind of showing what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's... Okay, I can see how that could happen, but I'm also kind of... That's not a healthy way of doing it. That, you know, that we talk about healthy breakups, that it's not going to be a pleasant thing no matter how you do it. but having one person screaming and shouting, or both of them screaming and shouting, or in some cases even attacking each other.
Yeah.
Like, not all of them are like that. Some of them are calm conversations, even though neither of them are feeling calm and both of them are in floods of tears or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a complicated thing because I do feel like there has been this put expectation put in the media to create that level of drama. But I do think that there are people who break up and it is an extremely dramatic affair.
Yeah.
But I also think that breakups can happen in very quiet and subtle ways. That doesn't mean that the emotion isn't there. That doesn't mean that people don't break down later or cry. But I think you're right that the throwing of dishes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to people who think it's perfectly normal to have a usual sort of spouse or boyfriend-girlfriend type row, and for them to start throwing things just past each other. And I'm like, that's not normal. That's absolutely not normal to me. And what I've come to realise is that a lot of people who come from that perspective, in the sense of, oh yeah, we smashed a few dishes and things, it's perfectly normal, seem to have come from family backgrounds where rows like that between their parents were normal, who also came from a perspective of rows like that between their parents were normal. So if you come from a family that shouts a lot, then shouting is your way of showing that you care about somebody and that something matters to you, which is completely anathema to me, because shouting meant that someone was incredibly angry and likely to be unpredictable to me in my childhood. That didn't, it didn't mean, oh, this person cares about you. It kind of meant, no, you need to shut up and get out of the way now, which is why I find it such a weird thing to get my head around that people think it's perfectly normal to throw dishes at each other.
Yeah. The other problem is that, okay, for fear of getting too political, not political, but, okay, so you know the case with Johnny Depp recently?
Yes.
And what was it, Amber Heard? Is that her name?
That's the one.
Yeah.
Heard, not Hart.
Heard.
Yeah.
And from all accounts, they had a very toxic relationship.
Yeah.
They were not good for one another. And obviously she made allegations that he had physically abused her. Now, I'm not saying that that didn't happen, but of course there's been these recent reports that have come out with recordings, which basically confirm the fact that she also hit him.
And threw things at him. And was... Yeah, it was extremely nasty. She was also caught enhancing slight bruises with makeup to make them look worse than they were.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid I've been a bit sort of very sceptical of her from the start, because I feel it's hard enough for people who are being domestically abused to come forward, whether they're male or female, without somebody coming forward and making allegations that have been at least partially falsified.
Yeah.
Now, I think it makes it more difficult for everyone else.
Yeah, and again, we don't know all the facts. From what we can see, we do know that it was not a good relationship between either of them, and that there was probably wrong done on both sides. But that's the bit that gets me was the idea that throwing things was somehow kind of meant to be a little bit normal, or that because she was hitting him, it was okay. Like, slapping someone across the face or smacking them around was somehow acceptable and was not actually viewed as an abusive kind of thing. I mean, they were both adults.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely. There was a friend of mine, he was a fair bit older than me, and I think we used to sort of meet up every so often and just have coffee and chat and stuff, and I asked him about his girlfriend, and he said, oh, well, we're sort of on again, off again. At the moment, we're off again. And I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And he said, no, I think it's probably for the best. I'm not sure that we're quite right together. And then a bit later on, he opened up, and it turns out that she'd been ironing, and he'd said something she didn't like. So she'd picked up the iron and flung it at his head. Ooh. from a distance of about 2 feet away. So he was really close. So this was a hot iron, which he luckily managed to duck, but it would have gone straight into his face otherwise. And there were other instances of this. And I said, that's spousal abuse. You know, okay, I know you're not married, but that's, you know, that's a domestic situation. You should probably not get back together with her. Spoiler alert, they got back together, and I think they've been on again, off again since. But I said, no, seriously, even if someone does some really good stuff for you, if they're regularly chucking shit at your head, it's best not to be in a relationship with them. But he was having difficulty, I think, with this mental flip that because she was the girl and he was the male, if she threw something at him, then it was still abuse.
Yeah.
And I think people do still have that difficulty. I mean, you see all these films, don't you, where the old, basically anything from 1920 through to sort of 1990, whatever, where a man makes an indelicate suggestion and the woman slaps him, and we all laugh because it's funny. And the thing is, there's actually no reason for slapping someone like that. Unless they've laid hands on you first, there is no reason for it.
Yeah. And I mean, like, usually in those kinds of situations, in films as well, it's because they're not actually together and he's made her feel uncomfortable. But within a relationship as well, it's just a bit dangerous, really, isn't it? The way that that's made normal. And certainly I think that even in a breakup situation, if that is the kind of thing that occurs where there's a desire to actually do physical harm, which actually manifests itself in that way, then it's a good job you're breaking up.
Yeah. It was something Amanda Heard said. It was a case of something along the lines of, well, I can't promise you that it's not going to get physical because I get so fucking mad. And I'm like, okay, well, that's straight out of, you know, all the guides they write for women's domestic abuse shelters. As in, you make me so mad, that's why I hit you. If he doesn't hit you, he doesn't love you, kind of thing. Except she was saying it.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's the difference? Yeah. So, yeah.
And
the screaming.
If someone makes you mad enough to make you want to hit them, then maybe you should not be in a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe seek some anger management help.
Yeah. And again, I don't know what he did to her. I don't know. All I know is that it just seems like a very screwed up general situation, and there's this weird kind of normalcy which is put on the idea of women chucking things at men.
It's like, yeah, that's okay. I have to say, the fact that she told a very one-sided story and has been telling a very one-sided story for the past 3 or 4 years makes me very sceptical, and things may well have happened from her end. But because she has not told the whole truth all the way through, she has made her veracity so much less than it could have been.
Yeah, I think you're right. Again, it's just a very complicated thing. And once more, I don't know what's happened on the side of Johnny Depp. As I've said, I'm almost certain that this was not a good relationship, full stop. So,
yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's just... It just freaked me out a little bit, you know?
Yeah, totally. Okay, so on the opposite side from screaming matches, the very, very calm adult splits. You get this when people say, no, I want to write a very adult, mature breakup scene. And that's fine, but that doesn't mean emotionless. So to say you want to say show something as being healthy in terms of breakups, to have both of them going, well, I think we should break up. Yes, I agree. It's not really working, is it? Kind of thing. Without any kind of emotion whatsoever, is just, that doesn't make sense. There's only 3 reasons that somebody would be completely calm during a breakup, really. One is complete shock. They just can't take it in. They can't get their head around it. So they just shut down and go really calm. The other is they don't care. They're not that into that person. Complete apathy. It's like, okay, you want to go? You go.
Yeah.
And the third one is they saw it coming. they knew it was coming, they just didn't want to press the doomsday button.
Yeah.
So if you're being perfectly calm like that. There is a middle ground between screaming matches and being a complete automaton. And that's where you let emotion creep through a bit, but you show that they're being adult and managing their own anger if there's a sense of betrayal or their own sadness.
Yeah.
Or what have you. Because they still respect and care about the other person and don't want to unduly upset them. Or even if one of them is being cruel and the other one is trying to understand why, and you know that they're sort of saving up the really bad reaction for when they're alone and they can't damage anyone with it. That, again, makes sense.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, I was watching Anne with an E yesterday, yeah. the third series. And I won't give any names for anyone who hasn't watched the series yet. But there is a breakup which happens there where basically one character is totally sidelined. They're not expecting it in the least.
Yeah.
And the other one is actually being very mature about it. And there's this great line where basically the character who's being broken up with is totally heartbroken because they thought they were literally about to get married, which was actually the intention. And they think that this other character is breaking up with them to be with someone else. And the first character is like, actually, that other person, I'm not with them, and they don't like me, they rejected me.
Yeah.
And the second character is like, oh, what, so I'm not even good enough to be, you know, second place. And the first character is like, you're an amazing person, you should never ever think that, you know, you're worth, you know, as a replacement. And so even though this character was breaking up with the other one, it was out of a place of, I realised that I loved someone else, and I couldn't do that to you. Even if I couldn't be with that other person, I couldn't just be with you because it was convenient for me. When you deserve someone who is 100% into you, who 100% loves you. And I really liked that portrayal because it was obviously very heartbreaking for the other character, who was obviously and understandably upset and angry and very, very heartbroken. But at the same time, there was no weird demonization of the other character, who obviously felt bad for breaking that person's heart and said, look, the moment I realized my feelings, I came to tell you. And I'm sorry that it went on for so long, because I really do like you, but I just don't like you enough, basically.
Yeah, and obviously it's horrible to be the person on the receiving end of that, but at the same time, that's actually more of a kindness than going through with something.
Yeah. Particularly because one of the characters could have very easily gotten away with having affairs while the other one couldn't, so...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so feeding into that, everybody handles heartbreak differently. Some people are a complete wreck for months. I think it also depends on who they've broken up with or who broke up with them, because it might be a case of they've had a string of, you know, quite happy, mutually satisfying, basically friendships with sex kind of relationships. Mm-hmm. Where they haven't been like massively swept off their feet by the other person. And then that one person comes along who just somehow flips all the switches. And if that person breaks up with them, it's kind of like, oh God, that's it for, you know, you're kind of a mess.
Yeah.
naming no names in terms of characters. But it's like, if you think back over... Again, naming no names, over friends' relationships or family's relationships, there's a chance that they might have broken up with someone and gone, yeah, well, it just wasn't meant to be. I'm a bit bummed out this week. And then they're back out discoing. God, back in the 80s. That was even before my time. they're back out on the dance floor the following week. And then there's the ones where it's a case of, oh God, no, this is a genuine period of bereavement, because a breakup with someone you genuinely love is a type of bereavement. Yeah. And so they're grieving for a while afterwards, quite understandably.
Yeah, I think you're right. And bereavement is the right word, because obviously for some people it's very possible to break up with someone and then to maintain a friendship.
Yeah.
But that's hard. You know, that's
it is hard,
hard.
And obviously you should never insist on it. Say you were the, if you were the dumper and they were the dumpy, don't insist on a friendship. Maybe they need time away.
Yeah.
To come back and see if they can try a relationship as friends. But it's not healthy. It's actually sort of a bit psychotic to kind of try and push people to stay on your terms alone, I suppose, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So, some people can do that and some people are happy to do that. It can be a very mutual sort of, yeah, this isn't working in terms of relationship, but let's stay friends. And they can do that.
Yep.
For some other people, it's really not that simple at all. And it would be a right, this is the end kind of thing.
Yeah.
In that you're dead to me now.
Yeah. Well, that it's going to be so much healthier if I just don't have any contact with you at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is obviously very complicated if you have shared friend groups and things. You both work in the same place, or what have you.
Yeah, that does start to complicate things.
Definitely. So when you're doing all this, it's a case of, while everyone's handling their breakups differently, try and avoid cliches, because not everybody deals with it the same way. My personal bugbears are women going, oh, he broke up with me, I'm getting a haircut. And this isn't just because I don't like going to the hairdresser myself. This is just a case of, that genuinely doesn't make any sense to me. Is this kind of like a take back your possession of your own body type thing? Or is it a case of, this is a whole new me? It's like, no, you just got your hair cut.
Okay, I can understand it a little bit more. And certainly I think that it's one of the quick things you can do to change your appearance. And I think sometimes, you know, attitudes can come with change. So a change of something, it's a lot harder to kind of change your body. It's a lot harder than say, I'm going to get a tattoo. You know, some people do want to get a tattoo, but it's the mark of something change. It's a physical change on you that kind of helps you reinvent yourself in some way. And it can just help give that kind of, make you feel a little bit fresher in yourself. It's not a fix all. But haircut or having your hair done in a particular way is a really excellent way of doing it, because obviously it's not permanent. You can change it back, you can grow it out, you can, you know, mess around with it a little bit. But it's one of these immediate big changes you make that can happen in an afternoon.
I can kind of see that. I suppose I'm coming from the perspective of, we broke up, but that doesn't mean I think there's anything wrong with me. So I've always gone from the perspective of, okay, I don't think there's anything wrong with me. I don't need to change unless I want to. So clearly that's me. But this feeds into the whole thing. Not everybody does it the same way. Not every woman is going to go, oh, I need to go and get a haircut now. Not every woman is going to sit and have litres and litres of ice cream in front of Netflix whilst crying. Some of us will go out and get pissed. And it's just, you know, do what makes sense for your characters, I guess. And I think the whole sort of ice cream cliche kind of bugs me, because it's become a bit of a joke. And yes, it is a joke. And I think if you want to sit down and eat 7 litres of ice cream, you knock yourself out. You know, it's up to you. But I hate it being depicted as I've been broken up with, I'm not worth anything, therefore I'm going to eat my feelings type thing.
Yeah. And to be honest, the thing is, it is also made into a joke and kind of takes away the legitimate, you know, conversation about that side of depression. And that's what depression can look like. It can look like eating very unhealthily, being unable to move, being unable to change or dress or get out of your pajamas or stuff like that. And I think that people often kind of just pass that off as a joke, which is a bit sad, really. It makes me kind of upset.
Yeah, it is, because these are cliches that are applied to women, whereas the male cliche as well, he immediately goes out on the rebound and has a one-night stand, which is, again, not a very mature response, but is somewhat more empowered than sitting and eating their body weight in ice cream.
Yeah, and it's also, the thing is, like, if you see a male character doing that, it's obviously meant to be as a form of comedy. Like, oh, look at that, he's doing the woman thing. He's sitting there sobbing, eating ice cream, and you're like,
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we need to wrap up this section because we're going on quite a lot. Don't apologise. It's me as much as you. And that is, be realistic with time, I think. And that's the sense of, yeah, as we've said, there are some people who are just a case of, no, nobody else will do. Okay, that's fine. But they're not going to spend their entire lives grieving for this one person. They're not going to not move on and have some sort of life. Or if they don't, there's something very wrong.
I wanna have a quick aside of this thing that I discovered the other day, which is amazing. And when I say amazing, it's deeply disturbing. So it's a thing from Asian fiction.
Okay.
Which might come from some form of kind of folklore or mythology or something like that, but has been very, very popular in fiction from places like Korea and Japan and China and a lot of anime and stuff like that and light novels. And it's this disease called Hanahaki disease. And it's this idea that someone who is in a position of unrequited love catches this disease, and a flower basically like this bush or this plant starts growing in their lungs, slowly suffocating them, and they kind of cough flowers basically and vomit flowers until they suffocate and die. And it's formed from unrequited love.
Okay, not strictly speaking anything to do with breakups, but interesting.
No, but it's this idea that it's been used a lot in fiction, and it's been used about this idea that, you know, so someone who's been left behind, you know, in a relationship, been left behind in a relationship, so it might be that they've been broken up with, and they can't get over it. They're still totally in love with this person who might have completely moved on. And on the one side, it's totally horrifying. I mean, physically and emotionally and just mentally, just the idea of it. On the other side, there's this weird, and it's, I hope you don't misunderstand me when I say, there's this very kind of Asian beauty to it. There's this very kind of like poetic style to the idea of coughing flowers because of, you know, of unrequited love, of a love which has been spurned or is no longer being returned.
Nope, I can.
And I just wanted to mention it, because obviously we are talking about breakups, and you know, we did mention the whole idea of the of, it's, you know, if you break up with someone, it's not going to be the last time, and that actually that breakup can actually lead to a better understanding of life moves on, and it's okay to fall in love with someone else, and it's possible to fall in love with someone else. But there is always that very dramatic side of, no, they were the only one for me, and I will literally die for love in a very physical, very poetic way. So I wanted to mention it because it's deeply disturbing, and yet, like, the imagery that's come out of it is weirdly beautiful.
Yes, so I see what you mean. It does sort of encapsulate the sort of hollow chest feeling, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, but it's just flowers, just coughing petals. It's so weirdly, disgustingly romantic, and yeah, I had to share it with other people because I was like, what?
But unless you have a plant growing in your lungs, generally time heals all wounds, and the length of time can depend upon the person. So, you know, it might be years for some people, it might be a couple of days for someone else. Okay, let's move on to characters who just cannot get it together because they can't get together.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things with that is the whole idea of the will they, won't they, creating suspense in a story, and the idea that when people get together it's very hard to create drama, which I completely disagree with. I think you can have a very healthy relationship being portrayed, which still has its, you know, domestic issues, because all relationships, you know, it's not right, we're together now, all problems are solved.
And everything's boring.
That's not how things work. Yeah. It's a constant conversation, and that's the whole point.
I think if you get two characters together and then you think, oh, well, that part of the story is now going to be boring, then you're writing a boring relationship. quite frankly. But obviously we've sort of touched on this a lot in a few previous episodes, but yeah, basically there's absolutely other stuff you can do with those two characters still being together and happy in a relationship. There are still going to be strains and pushes and pulls and things. It, as you say, it's a never-ending conversation. So yes, the will they won't they bit is fun, but as I've said before, you know, the foreplay has to end in some sort of action at some point. You have to resolve what you've started, otherwise your readers are going to stop trusting you.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with the will they won't they either, but I always just end up thinking about Jake and Amy in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, who've been married and in a relationship for a while now after a little bit of a will they won't they, and it's just, it's not changed the dynamic of the story at all.
Yeah, which is good.
So yeah,
Anyway, so these characters that who can't get it together, sometimes there's a really strong attraction, but at least one of them knows that if they ever did anything or acted on it, it would be a very bad idea. So, for example, looking at Tamora Pierce's Becca Cooper series, you've got Becca, who is basically a copper. She's a dog. And you've got the King of Thieves. And they are really, really attracted to each other. She makes no secret of it in her diary. She said, you know, he's beautiful to look at, and there's something she can't help liking about him. She's got a bit of a soft spot for the crooked rogue types. But at the same time, she's like, the thing is, we're on completely opposite sides, and this is not like a Romeo and Juliet situation. This is a case of, if I ever find out for certain that he murdered someone, I'm going to have him arrested and take him in to be hanged. Vice versa, if he ever found, if she ever got serious evidence on him that would have got him arrested, he would have had to had her silenced permanently. So they get on really well. They have a great friendship. He gets really jealous when she starts seeing someone else. But they know on some level that if they ever got together and started, if they ever started sleeping together or anything, everything would go horribly wrong. It would be an incredible conflict of interest. So they never get together. And it was kind of refreshing, because based on other, certainly young adult fiction, you expect one person to completely change their viewpoint and go to the other person's team. And that never happens. So it was refreshing to see something presented whereby neither of them are completely right and neither of them are completely wrong, but they're not right together and they know it. So they're attracted, but they never go anywhere with it.
Yeah. That's a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're somebody who starts the series by really shipping them and then it's kind of like, why does she end up with this bloke who's like, you know, a really, really nice guy, but obviously not as charming or beautiful as the rogue is? And it's a case of, well, actually, he's better for her. You know, just looking at it logically, he is a better choice and she is right to make that choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I like it in speculative fiction where you have a character who is wise enough to make a good choice for themselves romantically, ultimately. It's really refreshing to see that rather than the hammering away at a square peg into a round hole.
And I do feel like actually that's something that you do in your writing.
Yay!
And you know what? We've talked about this enough at this point that I'm just going to go ahead and say that hopefully this is not spoilers. But, you know, there's the whole dynamic between Lucas and Kieran.
Yeah.
And Lucas by far he's entrancing. He's charming in a way which is very particularly attractive for Em. They've both got that music.
Yeah.
You know? There's a real sense of intensity there. But at the end of the day, he's not necessarily good for her. He's good as a friend. He's good to push and challenge her. But in terms of a relationship, in terms of actually keeping her alive and well and balanced, he's not actually good for her. Which is why, ultimately, I never really paired them.
Yeah. I mean, I know quite a few people who were a bit disappointed the way it went. One in particular. And I do see his point as well. But I think you're right. Ultimately, she chose the healthier choice, even though that came with its own baggage. And they both had to really work at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And baggage it did come with.
Oh yes, on both sides. I suppose that feeds into this other trope, which is the whole sort of characters who can't get it together or won't get together. I had to choose someone. I do love you, but I chose somebody else.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I chose someone else because they were a better choice. I chose them because I genuinely love them. I don't feel that way about you, even though I'm attracted to you. Yeah. Again, horrible to be the jilted party in that situation, but quite often that is also a sensible reaction as well.
Yeah, I quite agree.
You can definitely present it in a way whereby someone has made a choice quite selfishly there. So I know you don't want me to mention Wuthering Heights, but I'm gonna. You've got, to be honest, Kathy shouldn't really have chosen Linton or Heathcliff. Neither of them were good for her, but of the two that matched her, she would have been better with Heathcliff in that respect. But she chose Linton for the absolute most selfish of reasons, and that was because she wanted to be rich.
Yeah.
So again, I love you, but I'm choosing someone else because you don't have a lot of money. So you can play it quite bitter as well.
Yeah. Also, the funny thing about the whole idea of I did it because I wanted to be rich is incredibly funny, because at the end of the day, her riches doesn't save her from the fact that she dies.
No, in childbirth.
Yep.
So yeah, it's not great. Okay, I'm going to touch briefly here, because we're talking obviously a lot about couples, and obviously a polyamorous relationship is perfectly valid too. So a big obstacle with characters who cannot or will not get together is I won't share you with somebody else.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily wrong. It just means that not everybody is designed for polyamory, just as not everybody is designed for monogamy.
Yeah. Completely.
This is obviously something Kelsey comes up against in a forthcoming story.
Yes. I think the problem with that is that we don't actually tend to get very healthy portrayals of that in the most part in fiction.
No, I agree.
And I think the whole thing with polyamory relationships and poly relationships in general is that they are complicated. It's not all sexiness, which I think is how it's portrayed a lot in the media. If you think of how much work it is to have two people in a relationship, imagine three people in a relationship.
Okay? Yeah.
So I do think that jealousy is actually probably does happen. But jealousy in a healthy way. I don't think it's actually necessarily unhealthy to be jealous of something or to want something for yourself. It's actually how you kind of allow that to build up inside of you, whether you address it or whether you don't.
Agreed. Yeah, definitely.
So I think jealousy can occur in a polyamorous relationship. And I'm talking about when you have polyamorous relationships sort of in general, not necessarily one person who is seeing someone else and then says, I want to bring in a third party.
Yeah.
Which, again, I don't think we see that portrayed very often. And again, it's valid to turn around and say, actually, that's just not for me. Just as it's valid to then say, actually, then I think we should break up because it's something which does matter to me, which I need.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But yeah, it's a really complicated issue. And I think the problem is that we do see these breakups in these relationships where there's polyamorousness kind of, or they just keep it relatively casual. But the whole thing is that it's not actually an even relationship. There's still this very pair, just the true love pair kind of idea which is put onto it, which is that two people are really the ones who are in love with each other, and the third is a bit of a tag on.
Yeah, and it does get portrayed that way, and that's something I'm trying to explode with Kelsey's Choice, which I promise I will finish in the next couple of months and publish.
Please.
I will finish it. Now, Kelsey actually has, without any real spoilers, Kelsey actually has a long and interesting conversation with Kieran about it, because Kieran wants to understand her position. And Kelsey more or less says, well, it's just that to me, to believe that one person can be everything to you is ridiculous. And the idea that you should expect that from someone is unfair, and it's unfair of someone to expect that from you. And as long as everybody's being honest and no one's being deceived, what's wrong with there being many, many loves within a relationship, all different and all equal? And, you know, I genuinely can see that perspective. I mean, I'm a bit of a social recluse, so I really don't have the energy to put into that sort of thing. And that's on me. So that's why I would not be suited to it. But I can absolutely see it for other people. And I say, you know, good on you if you can. The amount of effort to make one relationship work, let alone several at the same time. And balance them all so that everybody feels valued. Yeah. And the jealousy aspect is really interesting in the sense of... it's not an emotion I'm familiar with. It somehow something in my wiring has been left out, so I don't get it from a personal level. But from observation, to me, it looks like a fear of insignificance. It looks like being afraid that you do not matter to the person that you care about. And I think if you take the fear away from it, then it loses its teeth and it loses its power over you. And the polyamorous relationships I've seen, they've quite effectively defanged the serpent by being very, very honest with each other.
Yeah. And I do think that actually at the end of the day, that's how any relationship, but polyamorous relationships particularly, rely on that level of honesty. Which is why I get a little bit frustrated when you just see them portrayed as just this very, very sexy...
Yeah, thing. It's an excuse for regular orgies. And it's like... It's not really about that. I mean, it's not to say it can't be, but it's just, that's not all of it. That's as gross as saying, oh, you're bisexual because, you know, you're just a tremendous slut kind of thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way. We're not fulfilling quotas, you know?
Though we do have a quota to fulfill this year.
Okay, another big one. Timing. It's the wrong time for these two people. One of them zigs while the other one zags. Or one of them's just had a breakup, the other one's ready for a relationship. Vice versa. Every time. It just kind of doesn't work. Kind of a good example of that in speculative fiction is Murphy and Harry in the Dresden Files. Weirdly.
Yes.
One of them is always coping with some major, major trauma and can't deal with a relationship right now, thank you very much. Just as the other one's kind of like, yeah, I'm thinking about dating again soon, so are you free?
Yeah, and then it's like, now I'm ready, but now you're in a relationship with someone else, and I respect that.
Back off.
Even though there's obviously been this thing between them for a really long time. And I actually quite like that, because they're obviously really good friends, and they obviously have feelings for one another, but there's also this, actually, I like you as a person, and I tend to like the people that you're dating. And even when I don't like the people you're dating, I respect you. Like, at one point, Murphy starts a relationship with someone who is essentially a hitman.
Yeah. Well, there's no essentially about it. He's a hitman.
And it's not that she's in a relationship with him, it's just that they kind of, they're sexually attracted to one another, so they've been doing the do. And Harry's like, I don't get it, but okay. I respect your choices.
I also thought Harry was kind of like a bit, I'm right here. I mean, okay, I kind of had it off with Queen Mab, but I'm right here. But okay, fine, whatever you want. I have to admit, if Harry and Molly ever get together, I'm going to throw my shit out of the pram big style.
Yeah, I really, really don't want that in the least. And to be honest, so far as everything I've read about Harry, he really doesn't want it either.
So often he's a little bit tempted because he's lonely.
Yeah. Yeah. but please, please no.
And I must just take this moment to embrace the irony that I'm talking about a trope positively and using Harry Dresden as the example in terms of romance.
Oh, yeah. You're always going after the books I love, aren't you?
Well, deliberately. Yeah, it's not a case of, oh, Madeline loves, not going to tear this to shreds.
Madeline loves it. What's wrong with it?
Along with the wrong time, sometimes it's a case of we missed our moment. We had our moment and for whatever reason, both of us shied away at the last second. So we didn't get together and then other things happened and it's made it impossible for us.
Yeah. And I think that that's probably something that I've maybe touched on a tiny bit in the Hamartia cycle. Without confirming anything, I think... You're laughing.
I'm not laughing. That's a nervous laughter, Madeline. Every time you say without confirming anything about the Hamartia cycle, that is nervous laughter.
There are a couple of characters, without naming them, some people who are listening will know exactly who I'm talking about, who could have had a thing, and who I've written about having a thing, but who within the canon just can't.
Yeah.
With everything that's happened, it's just that there's just no way that it could work now. But I have written about them outside of that in different stories or different, you know, universes or you know, diverting things a little bit. Just because it was really to explore actually a relationship that would have worked quite well given the right circumstances.
Yeah.
But which absolutely can't now, and never would now.
Yeah, totally. And actually, that I think it's a sad trope in a way, and there's a lot of poignancy in it, but you can portray it in a way that shows a lot of wisdom and maturity on your character's parts. Or you can have it as just like a little background note of a what if, which can be quite a nice addition as well, all adding to the rich tapestry of your story. So yeah, time can be a really interesting constraint. Definitely.
Yeah.
The other thing is obviously a huge obstacle. So you've got two characters, they're really into each other. One or other, or both of them, has one really, really big thing that the other person can't get over. At the moment, I'm reading a series of books called The Chronicles of Elantra by Michelle Segarra, and I'm halfway through book 9, and the romantic subplot has yet to really start. Book 9, people. Now, I'm all for a slow burn, I really am, and I'm all for letting characters get really close and then yanking them away from each other, as you might have noticed. But book 9, I kind of expect things to have progressed a little bit, and it's not like they haven't really talked about it either. And the main character has essentially said, I don't know if I can get past the thing you've done enough for us to become more than just friends. And he's sort of said, I'll wait. He then goes on to wait for another 3 books. And I'm like, are either of you going to blink at some point? Because this is, I'm not in it for the romantic subplot, but it's actually not adding anything at all to the book, so it may as well not be there. It's frustrating and not in a good way. Not in a, oh God, I hope this is the book where they get together way. It's just kind of like, for God's sake, somebody do something. I should add that the thing that she can't get over is the fact that they were street kids. He was a bit older than her, and she brought a couple of other girls on board in their little gang. And because of some big magical thing that was going on at the time for which she was the focus, she was potentially in danger of dying in this ongoing ritual sacrifice. So in order to prevent that happening and to prevent her powers exploding out, he murdered the other 2 girls. He did it in a way that they didn't suffer, and then he buried them afterwards and everything. And it was kind of weirdly done with love, because he did care about them, he just didn't care about them as much as her. So I'm already at the, okay, if you think that's the thing you can't get over, then maybe you should just not be thinking about this. The fact that you've managed to be friends and work colleagues is probably enough.
Yeah.
But I mean, sometimes the big thing you can't get over is you cannot get over somebody's profession. So I guess Harry Dresden again would be a good example in the sense of, oh God, you're a wizard and you don't just find lost things like your advert says. Actually, you get into a world of shit every 6 weeks and I don't know if you're coming home or not. And I'm not sure I can live like that because it's driving me insane.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, she has been involved and she's been really badly hurt.
Yes. Yeah.
Murphy has been very, very badly hurt by it in a lot of ways, and she's really suffered because of it. And I can understand her basically not being sure she wants to entirely do that, but at the same time then also being in that, well, we've gotten this far, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Not just Murphy either. Is it Susan?
Yeah.
Sue?
Yeah,
Susan. Susan, who, you know, really does come off quite badly.
Oh, yeah.
In the whole thing. We won't talk about Susan too much. Bad things happen to girls called Susan in speculative fiction. But yeah, again, Harry is not a good romantic perspective in that respect. Because the big obstacle is he cannot stop being a wizard, which means he's on everybody's shit list. Something tries to kill him at least once a month.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to be honest, that also comes from the point of view of Harry being a bit not sure about whether he wants to start relationships with people.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, and we're not really going to talk about it too much, because I think we're going to talk about it in another episode, it's the same with the series The Witcher.
Yeah.
With Geralt. In that you've got this person who's in a profession which is actually really quite dangerous. And also may have done some things which a prospective partner can't actually forgive, even if there is this huge intensity of emotion.
Yeah, and then there is also the thing where this sort of, there's Geralt, but you can also say it sort of feeds into any of the vampire books you care to mention, in the sense of one person is functionally immortal, which means that unless some big change happens on the part of the other person, that person's going to die. They are going to watch them grow old and die. So they know that there is a world of pain coming for them. So there is a selfish aspect, but there's also a kind of, I would be stealing your life. I would be stealing the life you could have had if you weren't with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, again, for a number of reasons. gets a little bit complicated. So yeah, it's this whole thing of first of all, I could get you killed. Second of all, I'm gonna outlive you on so many levels.
And third of all, you know, there's the whole thing whereby you'll spend a life with me and then possibly your last 20 years of life regretting the fact that you were with me, if I can even keep you alive that long.
Yeah. Interesting thing, obviously, about The Witcher is that you've got Geralt and you've got Yennefer, who are both kind of in that position on the opposite sides.
Yeah.
In that Geralt is certainly a little bit more mortal than Yennefer is, but he's also he's a superhuman. They're both mutants in some way or another.
Yeah.
So he doesn't age in the same way. She certainly doesn't age in the same way. And neither of them can have children. That's the bit that kind of annoys me a little bit. It's just, they're like, I can't give you children. Therefore, we can't be, you know. You can't be a proper relationship, can't be a proper family or a loving relationship because we could never settle down and have children. I'm like, well, adoption's a thing. Also, yeah, but can you not just, like, be partners in crime and just be happy with that? Would that not be possible? But apparently not.
Yeah, that was thin reaching for an excuse, wasn't it, really? In order for it not to happen at that particular moment in time. There's lots of it. Weirdly, there is loads of examples of this particular, oh, we can't get together because in fantasy, it's almost a fantasy and science fiction specialisation in terms of the characters who and the relationship that cannot be. And it can be quite an enjoyable thing if it's done right. It can be very, very annoying, as in with the Chronicles of Elantran, literally nothing is happening, which wouldn't be so bad if the main plot had anything that was happening right now, but it doesn't really. So yeah, it's kind of, you know, I'm all for a really, really long series. I mean, I'm totally up for writing a 15 book series, but I swear to God, something will, no, lots of somethings will happen in every single one of those books. It's not going to be sort of like, well, here's point A and here's point Z. I'm going to take you through all the other letters of the alphabet, but most of the other letters don't matter so much, so there's not going to be as much in those other books. Sorry, I had to get that off my chest, apparently. But yeah, also works in terms of, you know, the romantic subplot. And it doesn't have to be a main thing, and it doesn't have to be the thing that draws readers back to the book. Although I have to say that aside from world building, quite often the romantic subplot is what makes a lot of readers care about the characters enough to come back and really get invested in the story. So it's a weird little circle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right. Weirdly enough, and I'm not really going to go on about this so much too much as well, I do kind of want to make an observation about also how relationships don't necessarily actually have to be romantic.
Absolutely.
And the whole breakup thing between friends can be just as devastating.
If not worse, you might be the sort of person who can weather a breakup with a lover quite with equanimity. And then your best friend turns around and dumps you and you're absolutely poleaxed and you spend 5 years grieving. You know, that's not unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly I think sometimes I've actually been more devastated by friendships breaking up than by than the actual kind of main pairing breaking up.
Yeah.
And again, watching Anne with an E, there was this whole thing where at one point two friends, they break up. It's Anne and Diana who are these bosom
That's
friends.
Really upsetting. That's upsetting in the book. It's upsetting in the series.
So upsetting. And I was so happy when they got back together again.
So, yeah.
Broke my little heart. But also the thing I've been the most heartbroken about from watching The Witcher was Geralt and Yaskia at the end there. That hurt more than anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm not ashamed to say it.
Yeah, because you're kind of invested in it by that point. You know...
Yeah, we should.
So, basically, if you want to write heartbreak, go for it. Really, really go for it. Try and make me cry. Or make Madeline cry, you know.
It's very easy to make me cry.
It's not very easy to make me cry. But, you know, give me that feeling that my heart might be weeping blood even though my eyes are bone dry. That's a thing that happens.
Jules is hella specific.
Well, yeah, I get dem feels. I just don't get... apparently I don't emote very well, I've been told. So I'm just probably not going to cry, unless it's Wolf Children, in which case all bets are off.
I just love the idea that you can look up and Jules has got a completely stony face, but then there's just blood just oozing. Like, oh my god!
It's a mortal wound!
It's alright, this is just emotional.
Don't worry, it's an emotional stab wound. That's going on a t-shirt. Sorry. Okay, the train is off the tracks now.
Yes. But that's okay, we are at the end of the episode. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, on Friday I went to see Birds of Prey, and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. Honestly, I have to admit I went in with not very much in terms of expectations, generally because DC aren't very good at bringing it when it comes to films of the universe in general. Marvel kind of has them beat, and because I'm not massively invested in Harley Quinn as a character. However, this was a really, really good film, and it wasn't a chick flick dressed up in superhero clubber, and it wasn't a superhero film where you had pseudo men bouncing around sort of pretending to be women kind of thing either. It manages to capture the emotional depth of you know, being a woman. Full stop, any kind of woman. And it was just really interesting. And they weren't sort of, it didn't do the preachy thing. It didn't do the preachy, we are a sisterhood. We are strong because we're together. It's a case of, no, we're all strong women and we've decided to work together because that's the best way of getting out of this situation alive, which I can appreciate. Obviously, it starts with Harley Quinn having been dumped by the Joker. Probably the best thing that could have happened to her. And I kind of liked it because it gave her character a lot more depth. As in, every so often, you got reminded of just how bloody intelligent she is. Clearly, she's got some serious low self-esteem issues, which is what a lot of the behaviour covers up. And she's also a little bit... She's a bit of a sociopath as well.
Just a tinsy bit.
So, yeah, it didn't bastardise her character. It did do the cliché haircutting, eating ice cream, crying in front of the television thing. Then she went out and got drunk a lot. But her grieving process was like super, super quick. And it was interesting in the sense of, yeah, while it did play to those cliches, which was a little bit sort of eye roll worthy, it also was a lot more about her finding out who she was when she wasn't with somebody. And that she had value in her own right as herself.
Particularly when the person she was with basically had groomed her.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And she kind of laughs herself a little bit about that as well. So it was... The character is painfully honest. And you can't help appreciating that. And then there are other great characters in there as well. Like you've got the cop Ramirez, who's always been bypassed over and credit is given to her male colleagues. And Black Canary, who... is a singer who's always been under the thumb of this particular mob boss. And, of course, Huntress. Huntress is a great character. She's played so well. She's kind of played like you would expect somebody who, ever since seeing her family slaughtered in front of her and being hidden under their dead bodies and then taken away and taught by a secret assassin school, would act. As in, she has no social frame of reference. She doesn't understand humour. Sarcasm goes over her head. And it's just, it's very, very funny. It's very good. So, yeah, I highly recommend that one. I was pleasantly surprised.
Alright. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.